for probably 6 or 8 years now, and at Cornell have been involved in the Women's Studies program. And my major areas have to do with women in employment, women's occupational aspiration and work motivation, and female sexuality. I also am, as many of you are, an endangered species, and this paper, or the paper whose title I borrowed for this program, which isn't quite what my remarks will be about today, is part of a series in which I've been examining, really for a rather long time, the possibilities for relationships between feminist scholarship and more traditional scholarship. And that's kind of what my contribution will be today. Before we start, let me ask you whether, as people went around the room, you could hear well enough. And if not, let me urge you to take the risk of moving in a little closer. It won't hurt anybody. It was last summer. And I've been revising it, and I really thought that paper would be read today, and I would make copies available. As I write and write and write, I discovered that the best I could do would be to produce an outline. And I would kind of limit my initial presentation, and through that outline, tell you sort of what I see as the problem, and then we can spend our time in discussion. I've changed the title of this because I think that the new title reflects the more pressing issue, which is the future of feminist scholarship. And I use as a background Kuhn's work on normal science, and particularly on the dynamic processes by which science is conducted. I think that's his contribution as far as I'm concerned. I believe Kuhn would say that what he describes as normal science is the ideal type toward which all of us engaged in scholarship are tending. I know he leaves out the social sciences, I think a bit of a smirk, and without apology leaves out the humanities and some more traditional bodies of scholarship. But today, the term scholarship has been used in a rather inclusive sense, and I'm comfortable with that. So I can certainly entertain arguments about why Kuhn is not relevant, but until I hear them, I will apply some of his ideas. What Kuhn means by normal science, I should say at the outset that Kuhn, when I set up Kuhn as a sort of straw man in the paper, because Kuhn has two ideas which should be in balance and are not in his treatment. That is the notion of a paradigm and the notion of a scholarly community. And I believe that in order to understand, or in order to make a prediction about the future of feminist scholarship, we will have to know very thoroughly how the community operates. And Kuhn gives much more attention to the development of the idea of paradigm than he does to the community, which is in fact defined by its adherence to a paradigm. I believe that the issue for this analysis is the politics of inclusion and exclusion. And I think we really have to understand how the academic community, and I use that term not without irony, how it works in order to assess, for example, you know, either at a theoretical level or at a practical level as people plan their careers and plan continued eating and continued being sheltered and practical things like that, that we sort of know what we're up against. As you know, what Kuhn has in mind when he uses the term paradigm is a whole complex of items which include a body of knowledge that is accepted as indisputable and the basis of further work by the members of the professional community, scientific laws, particularly instrumentation and methodology, the political significance of which Kuhn does not analyze, but I think it's absolutely essential. And if I don't get to it, you might remind me that I'm very interested in the issue of methodology.
Methodology?
That term has been used by Mary Daly and also John Roberts. I believe it's a profoundly political conception. What else? There is basically an epistemology that is often indistinct, embedded in paradigms, and that is something which I think will become more apparent to us because of, as you'll see, what I think of as the nature of the feminist challenge. There is also very important in terms of studying academic careers, there is a priority or prioritized research agenda, which is part of the paradigm. Now, Kuhn says essentially that all scientific disciplines, and as I said, I would include other scholarly disciplines, tend toward the state of normal science. It's only within normal science that inquiry is completely governed by the paradigm. And Kuhn talks about something which I'm not going to talk about much today, which is a rather totemic image of a chaos that you put over. So that for me, one of the points, I should say that I do admire Kuhn. I would not be rehearsing his ideas if I didn't find them useful. But it's a very patriarchal kind of philosophy of science. And when I say it's totemic, that's part of what I mean. He completely incorporates a kind of winner-loser psychology, which I don't think necessarily valid. I think it's quite possible, as Ritzer and others have said, that the social sciences can never get to the stage of normal science, that there will not be the dominance of one paradigm over all others. And to the extent that we structure scientific careers as though that were the end, there may be unintended consequences. I will hold out as a possibility that, in fact, feminists structure inquiry in ways different from how the men who trained us continue to do it. And believe me, I'm out on a limb when I say that. I'm creeping up on being able to define the feminist paradigm, the paradigm of feminist scholarship. Given that reservation, I'm not sure we're going to do it, but I know it's taken me a long time to be able to get some content into this. I have a definition, which, with great apologies, I will do. In any case, partly because of this dynamic perspective, Kuhn writes as though change in the scientific community were inevitable. He takes the long historical perspective. He doesn't worry about individual scholars who fail to survive. He doesn't worry about 10 years of wasted time before information which was available in 1967 is incorporated in the curricula of our colleagues. And those are issues that concern me. But I'm not taking a historical perspective. I think there's another flaw in Kuhn, which is that basically, and one of the weaknesses of his treatment of community is that he assumes social homogeneity within the scholarly community. The only way he can transcend the competition between generations is to assume that the challenges are at some level acceptable to the people who now, at any historical moment, control the discipline. And I'll say right out, when the challengers are females, I don't think that assumption holds. And one of the points that I get to in my outline is, in what ways is the challenge from feminist scholarship different from this normal situation that I've been describing, where there are paradigms around which knowledge is organized and they're in competition until one of them proves to be more powerful? Another point from Kuhn, and then I should leave him, is what he writes about resistance and the adoption of paradigms. Kuhn tries to defend himself because people have claimed that he presents science as an irrational enterprise. And there are those who feel really uncomfortable with that criticism. But in fact, when he starts to talk about resistance and about paradigm change, he suddenly switches to a rather metaphysical vocabulary and talks about conversion. He says, basically, no paradigm which is a challenger ever succeeds on the basis of weight of evidence. That's the way the argument is made. But a paradigm in its early stages cannot be sufficiently potent to completely sweep aside the prior incumbent. So in fact, what happens is that people become converted. Now, Kuhn hasn't spelled out this process at all, but the one observation he offers is that what happens is that members of a new generation become converted, and that the members of a group which has profited under the old regime are very unlikely to become converted, and they basically die off. This is, of course, very consoling to those with a historical perspective. Not at all consoling to people like me. But in any case, now one of the questions that I'm interested in is then the issue of the professional pipeline and the
question again as to whether social attributes of members of the community who bring a challenge have something to do with the probability that their challenge will be accepted. And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, I'm saying I think there is sexism among graduate students. And I think that to the extent that graduate schools are following the behest of the Carnegie Commission, cutting back on their programs, we're going to cut back on the proportion of women in the pipeline. I have some other things to say about the pipeline. And I think that this is a serious problem. I do not think that the challenge from feminist scholarship is a normal paradigm challenge, and I don't think the history of it is going to be resolved in the way that Kuhn represents as normal. Okay. So then my second concern has to do with the scientific community, and I will just throw out some headlines here because this comprehends a great deal of literature which I couldn't possibly do justice to. From Kuhn we get the idea that a scientific community shares a paradigm. In fact, the paradigm represents a belief system, and to the extent that you dissent from the paradigm in any substantial way, you really cannot be considered a member of the community. Now, I believe that has implications for feminist scholarship, because I have tried to periodize feminist scholarship in the earlier version of this paper, and I think that, in fact, feminist scholarship inevitably leads people to dissent from the dominant paradigm in not one, but several ways. And I have sort of a value-added theory of deviance that says you can predict the magnitude of the punitive response to deviation on the basis of how many deviant points you add up. And I'll come back to that, because I want to give feminist scholarship its due. In any case, Kuhn, it's very interesting how civil Kuhn is. And although he talks about scientific revolution, there's almost a playful, figurative, quality to it. It's elegant and delightful, but you don't get the sense that there's any bloodshed. And I believe there is bloodshed. I believe we're in a period of backlash, which threatens all of us. Those of you who have tenure, congratulations, perhaps you're not as threatened as those of us who don't, but I think there's an element of threat.
Could you, can I just ask you, these ideas, was this book the structure of the scientific revolution?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's where I get my ideas on Kuhn. Kuhn doesn't have all the criticisms of Kuhn that I do.
Would you give us a name and title?
Thomas S. Kuhn. It's a beautiful, shocking pink paperback called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and you should get the current edition because it has a postscript in which he tries to take into account the many criticisms and reactions that he's received since the initial publication, which I think is 1966 or 7, right?
How do you spell his last name?
K-U-H-N. And boy, I really am vulnerable to the criticism of not citing female theoreticians, because the only people I'm going to talk about today, aside from instances of scholarship itself, are Berger and Luckman, whom some of you know already, and Kuhn. But this is just a sketch. In my work on the scientific community, I've emphasized the nature and functions of professional networks. And I have some of the ideas on community that I develop here are the work of my student Larry Kummer, who is doing a study of networks in the community of feminist scholars, and to see what they include and don't include, what kinds of goodies are flowing through those networks. Of course, the world's expert in that, Arlene Kaplan Daniels, is here. And let me just say, most of you know what kinds of resources flow through those networks, but one of the things we're interested in is citation studies. There's a great deal of documentation of the existence and functioning of feminist scholarship which people could undertake and which I think is overdue. I consider citation studies to be just the beginning of that work. The scientific community, in spite of what Kuhn would have you believe, is stratified the way the real world is, which means the basic dimensions of social stratification determine outcomes in this community. Of the evidence that I've seen, gender is the most powerful of these, race perhaps second, and age third, although age is confounded with rank in our occupation. So in fact, rank turns out to be more powerful in some of the studies of the professional community.
Class.
Okay. Class. Yes. All right. That's interesting. The data that I've been following take individuals as a unit of analysis, and it's easy to overlook. I think class is more than variables that you can peg to individuals. So I'm glad to be corrected in that respect. I think the real phenomenon, by the way, I should say, Kuhn works as though the intellectual level, which is what he analyzes, were the real stuff. That's all there is. In fact, I think the social and political are more important. So I view this whole question as a problem in the maintenance of boundaries. And I haven't done much on that, but I have noticed the vital importance, the vividness to me of magical code words which discriminate perfectly who is inside and who is outside. And there are lists of those that I call lists of dirty words and lists of magic words. And for academia, for example, I think that Dick Lester's book is the magic word book. If there's anybody who doesn't know it, it's a very funny book. Also done, it's called Anti-Bias Regulations in Universities. A very funny book, but not very
not
funny.
Meant to be
funny. Not meant to be funny. It is a magic word book. This is a study which I don't think I'm doing him any justice to say. He asked all of his cronies what negative effects they would anticipate if affirmative action were ever to become a reality in universities. And they told you all the stuff. You got basically their answers. I didn't see any exceptions to this. Could be codified in terms of threats to the magic words. The magic words are things like standards, excellence, meritocracy, and so forth and so on. A part of this paper, which isn't written yet, unfortunately, has to do with the fate of affirmative action in universities. And although it's a very complex question, and there are many, many good contributions to that literature, I think you could go a long way in just looking at magic words and dirty words to understand the brief and painful history of affirmative action. Well, oppression is a dirty word. Discrimination is a dirty word. And by the way, I haven't found in the social science literature, with the exception of the work on the economics of discrimination, any kind of substantive or operational definition of discrimination, sex discrimination. I haven't found it. It doesn't exist as a problem in our literature. Okay, that's the kind. If you use the word oppression, you violate the canons of civility. It's a dirty word in certain communities. Am I wrong about that? All right. And conversely.
Equality is, I think, weird because it's right on the line.
That's right. It is right on the line. But do you remember that there used to be courses in social stratification, which of course is an establishment type word. I mean, there are clearly shadings here, and I'm not competent to do them justice. But in our university, the person who used to teach social stratification now teaches social inequality. Our crypto-Marxist. I mean, for want of any other, this person is our Marxist. all right. One of the questions that I want to develop is basically a social psychological one, which comes out of an item that Hume deals with and all the sociology of occupations deal with, which is the issue of professional socialization and the related issue of personal identity and professional identity. And I will jump to my next section and say, in terms of how social science is distinctive, how we have to remember that it's different from the kind of disciplines that Hume's talking about, it appears to me that the variables we study have some personal relevance for some people, and that inevitably has repercussions. It has repercussions which are well documented by, for example, Cindy Epstein and many others. I've done work on the psychology of tokenism, and Rosabeth Kanter has just published a paper on what she calls skewed sex ratios. The general effects of skewed sex ratios, it could apply to other minority and anomalous statuses, that any person, regardless of their intellectual work, regardless of her intellectual work, is going to be reacted to in terms of the social signification of her obvious attributes. And that's so obvious it shouldn't have to be said. It doesn't appear anywhere in Kuhn or in any of the philosophy of science and most of the sociologists. Cantor? It's the current AJS or ASR. That's American Journal of Sociology or American Sociological Review, and I think it's ASR. Let's see, okay, I'll come back to this point. The last point is the point about methodology or methodolatry. And I don't think that Kuhn has made enough of this item. It is an element in what he terms the paradigm, which when it is adopted by a community is swallowed whole and is ordinarily not made problematic, not a basis for discussion. The whole point is that you can go ahead and have the kind of scientific progress where each little bit adds on and accumulates and the millennium is just around the corner, only under conditions of normal science, because you don't have to discuss anything, you just go ahead and do it. I am told there are some feminist communities like that, and in that case I don't think it's such a bad thing, but in the case of normal science I have my doubts. It should be obvious that methodology is a very potent boundary maintenance function. In other words, you can only engage in privileged discourse within a community if you can meet the canons of validity, and those are mostly defined in terms of methodology. The more evolved toward normal science a discipline becomes, probably the more emphasis there will be on methodology. And of course, I think there's something terribly masculine about this whole thing. And I was thinking during one of the talks this morning, there is something irresistible to men about dualities. And I consider the subject-object one to be the underlying domain for this concern about methodology. Why is it that men feel the obligation or the necessity? I don't think it's an obligation. I really think the explanation is psychological. Somebody would probably kill me before I walk out of here. I don't know what it's about, but I think that what's going on is that I observe certain behaviors which seem to have the meaning of maximizing distance between the individual scientist and experience. So what you do is you simplify, you operationalize, you put things in the laboratory, you exercise experimental and statistical control, and the best thing you could possibly do is to do simulations. All right? You understand what I mean? I think there's a dimension there. And I think that is very different from the way women, and I'm leaving aside the effects of training now because I think we share training with our male colleagues.
Are you just talking about technological?
It's very difficult for me to separate instrumentation from other issues of epistemology.
The whole notion of experiment or subject and how that is set up in a small room and stuff, it is very clear that the patriarchy and the patriarchy
migrate. See, there are more things to it than just the use of a special space. I mean, religious observances, which of course some people have seen parallels here too, also use a set-aside space for certain kinds of ritualized activities. But you're right, there's much more to it that's patriarchal than that. And I think one of the best examples that I've ever seen is the script for the famous Milgram experiment, when the real subjects tried to get the experimenter to respond to their concern about this poor victim that they were shocking. And the experimenter, in fact, didn't answer any of those comments. He had a script. I can't remember whether they ever ran a variant with female experimenters. The experimenter had a script, and the experimenter would just keep repeating the directions to continue with the task. That kind of interaction is very peculiar, that you can make a direct statement or demand about feelings, about the necessity for yourself in the situation, and the person continues business as usual. I think that's very patriarchal, right? I think that's a good example.
What about the humanistic psychology?
Yeah. Well, you see, there's nothing wrong with the humanistic psychology stuff on paper, but and I've been doing a thing on androgyny, so I've been reviewing this. It doesn't make me as nauseous as it did a few years ago, but I noticed that, again, they're not really talking about women. When they talk about, basically, they're talking about personal liberation, which is marvelous and a very good perspective in psychology, but they're basically talking about liberating men from the kinds of things that have constrained men. And they do not yet, because they don't take the social categories corresponding to gender seriously, they can't possibly make a potent analysis of what liberation for women would be about, and they don't. And in that community, no one challenges them on that. So
but
I don't see that as a good corrective.
On the methods that they use,
compared with these other methods we're talking about, I think, society.
I have no idea whether there are any research methods in that approach. I have the problem.
What is an alternative?
No idea.
I mean, I'm trying to make the leap between having that experimenter repeatedly say, you know, follow the instructions, or whatever.
Go on to the next word.
My immediate thought is it's authority, all the things that came out of the study. And I think, okay, what are alternatives to that? And why? What makes that patriarchy? Is it not a presumption that matriarchy, the opposite is not the same. I mean, you know, what makes that?
You're asking probably the toughest question if you take it to methodology. And all I can say is I think there's a continuum, and there are some extremes that I think are not justifiable, either in ethical terms or in terms of validity, what human beings are about.
Right.
Of course, that's very unscientific to say that. I can't represent myself as any kind of model, but the kind of research that I'm doing and my students are doing in human sexuality is very different from that. You mean the individual is the expert on her own history, and you can worry about invalidity and biases of various kinds, you can control on them, but the stance of the researcher vis-a-vis the respondent is so different. I mean, when I was trained in social psychology, and social psychology has moved to the far right, as far as I'm concerned, in the last 10 years, so that in fact perhaps social psychology has reached the stage of normal science, and there it's paradigm bound and all that other stuff. But certainly the payoffs, what was good research design was to find things that were extremely cute, that all involved deception, that all involved manipulation. And the real question was, it's like this business of pesticides and herbicides, you know, as the subjects become less and less naive, you try to figure out more and more complex ways to fool them. And I just have retreated from that line of thinking subsequently. People keep telling me there is a new methodology implicit in my own work, and I wish they wouldn't be so coy and just come out and tell me what it is. No. But, you know, I think that's where we're going. I don't have an answer for you right now.
Yeah, I guess the other part that, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of the more practical aspects of the experimental design, obviously you can have female experimenters, male experimenters, you can try to have situations where neither of those is the dominant person in the study, so that the subjects don't see either a female running it or a male running it. You can have, I mean, there's so many ways, but that doesn't seem to deal with the issue that you're getting at, which is more subtle, which is that in either case, those people are still your girls and represent a kind of like,
well, for example, I mean,
one place where in the past there has been some research, and again it's been considered unscientific, was Piaget's work. And that's, I'm not saying that that's a perfect model, but that was a different model, and it's just unscientific. But nevertheless, the contribution is
there. I would say that you could still gain satisfactory levels of logical and scientific rigor with research situations that were much more reciprocal. When my students do research, they have to offer the participating person something in return. You know, none of this crap about you come in and we're going to do a few things to you, and it's all for science and out you go.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't find, I'm moving more and more into, not because I really am into community research, but because the phenomena I'm interested in exist in social organizations, they have to find a way to make that research sell to those who are the people who are going to contribute. If they can't, the research doesn't get done, period. Now, that's a very different kind of set of constraints to adopt. I just think the issue of methodology is extraordinarily complex. I have no good ideas. I furthermore think that good methodology is always a match between the problem and the method. And that's why a term like methodology is meaningful to me. If you tell me, I'm no better than I tell them, there are people who cannot, in my field, who cannot read anything that isn't in, who can't read anything that isn't in the the third generation developed from path analysis and regression statistics cannot read anything in any other methodology. So that says is, what that says is that that which fits into the shackles of methodology now defines our field and anything else. One of my colleagues refers to me as an essayist. I'm working on that, you know. Eventually I will be able to say, oh, thank you. Now I know that you understand what I'm trying to do. But from the point of view of where we are, with this kind of awfully imitative tagging after the physical sciences, I know he intends that as a deadly insult. There's no ambiguity about that. All right, and it's precisely because of this kind of continuum, this kind of progression that I've been talking about in Kuhn. The more like physics we can become, the better we will be. All right, so social science is different for reasons, as I've suggested. The issue of consciousness is one that I want to work on, and I would like for people who have ideas about it to throw it in. There is no sociology of the white male, and I don't think that's an oversight at all. I think that's true for exactly the same reason. I think the reasoning about it is exactly the same as Kuhn uses when he talks about the paradigm within normal science. That is to say, that which is not problematic does not get discussed. When you have no variation on a variable, it's not a variable in the sense in which we use that term in science. And what that means, aside from a perhaps lamentable lack of studies in the sociology of white males, is that it's extraordinarily difficult to get those people to pay attention to a systematic sociology, just to take an example of women, blacks, gay people, or what you will. All right? The problem, one of the things I talk about is as patriarchal science, is that, that the male is considered normal. You know, somebody said that this morning. It's not that we have two groups. We have two gender classes, which is how we know it is. It's that in our thinking as scientists, there is humankind, and then there is those others. Or the other, if you happen to be from a humanistic tradition, the other, cap T, cap O. As Beauvoir remarks, it matters not whether the characterizations of the other are benevolent or hostile. That matters not. That doesn't affect the logic of that thinking at all. Some of you may be aware of the work that Suzanne Prescott and others have done on authorship of scientific articles, and Suzanne's work is addresses the question of when do authors generalize from their study sample? And it perhaps won't surprise you to know that when the experiment is run on males, they generalize to all persons. When the experiment is run on females, they say female subjects, and they don't generalize at all. This is an old, old point, but it's absolutely pervasive. Okay. Then I have a section on the sociology of knowledge perspective. And this is where I really depart from Kuhn, because I think that Kuhn tells us a great deal about what John Stuart Mill called the herd of studious men. A nice phrase. Mm-hmm. But he's completely oblivious to their herdness and to their manness. And I think those are the two critical factors for understanding how scholarly communities work, particularly the herdness. And this is something that I've just become aware of. From recently reviewing Maccabee and Jacqueline's book, they don't become aware of this, and I would like other people to check my objectivity on this, inter-rater reliability. But I observe an awful lot of studies that demonstrate a much greater sensitivity of young males. Most of the research they review is basically of people who are adolescent or younger, to their peers, to their male peers, and the group. The peer group as a context for male activity I'm very familiar with because of my work in human sexuality, but I think it's terribly, terribly important when I try to unravel some of the specific puzzles I'm interested in. For example, I'm interested in the study of personal violation. I've been studying rape, now I'm studying wife abuse, and I find that one of the critical factors is that men expect social support from other men for doing these kinds of acts, for rehearsing them in fantasy, for bragging about them. Now that, you cannot understand it intellectually or deal with a social problem, if you don't realize that there is an audience and a supportive group, that male solidarity is one of the basic facts of the social world that we live in, and it's one that we haven't studied nearly enough. The herdness of academic men. Sociologists of knowledge say, where you stand depends on where you sit. These concepts are very fascinating, beautiful, subtle, and would take me too long to go through them. But the bottom line, I've relied a great deal on Berger and Luckman in my work, which is a 1967 book called The Social Construction. Social Construction of Reality, right? Okay. The bottom line from that approach is that the sociology of knowledge teaches us to ask, says who? All right. Now, remember, was it Minnick this morning who said, talking about the authoritative role of knowledge in society and how academic types have monopolized the definition of knowledge in society. We really, given that analysis, which I agree with, we really have to ask, says who? And the answer from the studies of the academic profession and all the professions is fairly unambiguous. Now that has something systematic to say. The kinds of theory, the kinds of data, the kinds of research priorities, the kinds of epistemology, the kinds of collegial relationships that are established all reflect the maleness and the herdness of people who are responsible for authoritative statements. So I say then, therefore, it's a great surprise to everyone, I then say normal social science is patriarchal. Kuhn is patriarchal. And the whole tradition in social science of value neutrality, objectivity, and so forth. Weber, you know, this same student of mine caught my attention by revealing to me the history of how Weber, let's see, what kind of bargain it was for Weber to cop into that value-neutral kind of position. He did it in order to gain space to do the work he wanted to do in a situation where social science was expected to have some social utility and tie up with the political world, and he didn't want to do that. So he invented a handy concept that would get him out of it, and that's one we've inherited quite uncritically. In general, what I think is patriarchal, and I have not finished the list at all, is first of all a denial of value. That's what objectivity is. It's a lie, but it's put forth, the value neutrality is put forth as a value. Secondly, the denial of feelings, particularly own and others. Own and others. And I invite you to look at, all of you who read professional journals have thereby been trained to edit. And I invite you to look at your own writing and others and see the kinds of things that you circle with that blue pencil. They're almost always expressive and unprofessional rules. Right, when I do that, or I put puns, following the brilliant example of Pauline Bard, I usually put puns in my titles in various places. I have a paper in which I have a section that's called The Fallacy of Misplaced Concreteness. And of course I spell it PH, and the editor just take that out. That's got to be an error. Mary Carley has a chapter in my book which has a running head that on the page proofs came out as fact or friction. Now I'm not sure what she intended, but out that goes. People couldn't possibly be talking about what they appear to be talking about here. You think about all the tabooed topics and the vocabulary that denotes them. Denial of feelings is extremely important. If you look at the professional literature on rape, you find what I just said exemplified in a much more serious way. Victims' feelings are never part of the record. I only know of one study where victims' feelings were constituted as able to study, and that's not a social science study. And I've never seen that study. Playing house? Nope. Now I should, if I had the paper with me, that's two. Okay. Denial of injury. I have a definition somewhere here, which I ought to try out on you, which I probably can't find. So basically, I say something about patriarchy. By patriarchy, I mean a social system which actualizes dominance of women by men, together with ideology, knowledge, in quotes, as sociologists of knowledge use that term, and socialization practices which render such dominance expected, natural, and real. Now, I haven't developed that definition to be specific to the way social science is conducted, and I'll need to do that. But consider, if you will, for a minute, the other problem that I can't get into, which is the fate of affirmative action. I wanted to analyze in parallel the history of women's studies and the history of affirmative action in universities. I consider women's studies, among many other things, to be, perhaps the background is what we've learned about occupational segregation. I believe that the greatest threat that women can pose to men is economic competition. And that's a threat that most men have not yet experienced, because more than 70% of all workers in America are in occupations where most of their co-workers are of the same gender. That is one of the basic social arrangements of our society. If you can ghettoize women scholars, you would essentially are not competing with them. And if you look at Kaplow and McGee, which is an old study of academia, it's never been effectively disputed. And what they say about women is, you can hire one if you want. It can't hurt you. It can't help you. Because the game is about prestige, and women are outside the prestige game. Period. Women are other. Can't hurt you, but it can help you. Okay. So obviously, if you can get, you know how at the University of Chicago, which is where I taught before I went to Cornell, they used to have a home economics department, and there you had your female political scientists, your female philosophers, your female mathematicians, your female sociologists, and guess what? They got rid of home economics. And guess what? Got rid of all the women faculty members. Yes, and there is, if you look at the pathetic statistics on the proportion of women on the faculty of the University of Chicago, you find this awful trough, you know, down from 10%. And what that represents is, what that represents is the eclipse of the home economics department. All right, I, by the way, have been for a long time a strong proponent of women's studies, but I do recognize that one of the functions of women's studies serves for the larger academic communities and ghettoization of what would otherwise be perhaps an uncontainable, subversive, competitive group. All right. One more. You know, I think what I'm going to do is leave you with my final point for a discussion and try to say a little bit about the challenge from feminist scholarship.
Before you do it, I think we have an objection to smoking.
I also have a definition here which I'm not satisfied with, but perhaps we'll start some thinking about why the challenge from feminist scholarship is different. Here I say, feminist scholarship is that scholarly work which, one, takes the study of women as its central focus, two, which is committed to going beyond simple description of the status quo, and three, which is concerned with the social uses of knowledge about women. That can't begin to say what feminist scholarship is, but you can see right away that it's quite different from. Okay. One is, it takes the study of women as its central focus, not an add-on. No, not this ridiculous double standard that we find in most of the scholarly disciplines. Second, which is committed to going beyond simple description of the status quo. Study of sex differences is not feminist scholarship. Simple description of the status quo. And three, which is concerned with the social uses of knowledge about women. This is not very ivory towerish. Okay. What other things I thought about? First of all,
can I ask you why, if there is such a thing, you didn't mention feminist methodology?
Because I don't know yet whether there is such a thing. I think we are tending in that direction. In fact, I hope that the discussion here will give me a little content. It's very fuzzy in my mind.
About teaching women.
You know, that's interesting, because a lot of the feminist psychologists I know have taken the teaching of methodology as their entree. It never occurred to me. Never occurred to me.
You mean methods of teaching?
No, no, I mean methods of doing research. And then you get to select what examples you use.
Yeah.
Well, you deal with professional ethics.
Teaching.
Ah.
Feminist.
I haven't thought about that. I mean, this is obviously a category that needs to be expanded. Let me say something that I think is very important. I really agree with Mary when she said this morning, I don't think we're at a place yet where we can elegantly define in a you know, exclusive way what is feminist scholarship, but we're working on it. I believe that the conflict over naming is absolutely central to this challenge and to what constitutes feminist scholarship. You can see a connection with what I said before about dirty. Kuhn is like that all the way through. He never uses a sex-neutral term when he could say men. In any case, marginality is, by the way, for those of you who are optimistic about the future of feminist scholarship, marginality is one of the things we have going for us. I'm not optimistic because I think that marginality facilitates discovery but impedes being persuasive vis-a-vis the existing community, which is, after all, the people you have to sell. But that's the final question that I'm getting to is, what is the future of feminist scholarship? What models could we use to predict? You know, what does our gut tell us? Feminist scholarship is interdisciplinary, and it runs counter to the tradition which Kuhn, I think, describes accurately of necessary and accepted parochialism in the scholarly fields. It's bound to run up against that. Feminist scholarship is political, in quotes. And when I started playing around with what on earth does that mean? I mean, I know what it means. Men politicize my work all the time. But consider these possibilities. A man's home is no longer his castle, as his wife is becoming politicized. The profession is no longer a men's club, as women are becoming professional. The personal could become professional if the insistence on hard methodology is surrendered. That's really, the politics of methodology is pivotal, I think. The professional becomes personalized if you have to consider people's feelings or rights as human beings, which is not a patriarchal thing to do. The politics of private life becomes an object of study. I'm thinking particularly of domestic violence, but there are many, many examples. Nancy Hammer's work is a brilliant example of things which are, what feminist scholarship does is names things which are denied under patriarchal science and redefines things that are distorted and claims things having to do with women that are ignored. All those things are part of the conflict of naming. I believe, and I haven't done anything adequate with content of feminist scholarship, but some of the examples that I've been working with, what seems to be in common among them is the study of unacknowledged power relations. It, of course, goes with what I said about patriarchy, that most power relations should be unacknowledged. And, of course, goes with our interest as a class, that we should study them and study them effectively. Feminist scholarship studies women on their own terms. And here, my speculation is that more and more, this will lead us toward our orthodox methodology. In sociology, that's likely to be something in the neighborhood of phenomenology. In part because there is a challenge to the kind of dualistic epistemology of subject and object and so on. I think there may be a better answer than phenomenologies, but in any case, that's clearly, there is an affinity between questions and methods, as there should be all along the spectrum, but given the kinds of questions that feminist scholars are now asking, they're going toward other methodologies. I should say, by the way, that in the process by which a woman scholar becomes a traitor to her discipline, I think that probably abandoning methods orthodoxy is a more potent threat than just studying women. Now, I don't consider all studies of women to be feminist scholarship. If they don't challenge a patriarchal paradigm, I don't consider them to be feminist scholarship. But my analysis of the academic community is that if you do work on women, it's not on the research agenda. It doesn't help anything. It's not going to help you advance professionally. It's not going to hurt anybody unless it's political. So you're not going to get punished as severely by doing that as you will if you start to challenge the methods orthodoxy. And given the fact that social science is basically not monistic in methodology, you can float around and find yourself a methodological community. The way to get your head chopped off is to do work that challenges the patriarchal paradigm. I mean, but there are what I'm saying is, as I see it, there are degrees of risk you can expose yourself to. I have some thoughts about what feminist scholar study, as everyone does. So, I would like to end up with a question of what is the future of feminist scholarship? How much of my analysis are you moved or obligated to buy? And if you do, what are the implications? And if you don't, what are the additional options that can be generated? Is it our thought that we should take our break first and start talking? How do people feel? It's after 3 o'clock. We thought that we would take a break after an hour.
Would you like to?
It's just getting interesting.
Well, but I haven't been sitting listening all this time. I can't just sit for an hour if that's a question. Yeah, I think it's four. Is it 4 or 4:30? We can go till 4:30. We have a lot of time. Is that comfortable for everybody? Let's say we have to go down again. So why don't we start over here? Two questions.
Okay, I have a question. I'm coming from a different place. I think there's a lot of women who are here who are already scholars, from what I've heard. I'm on the way, hopefully, becoming a feminist scholar, and I'm not quite sure how to do that. Because I'm an undergraduate at a very patriarchal school right now at Fordham, which is fine, and I'm angry a great deal of the time, and I'm also a lesbian, and I come out with my feminist views, and it really, I mean, it's shaping up a lot of classes, but it's good, because it's leading, I can see, it's leading to a lot of things. However, the field of study that I am basically interested in, because I have a strong Judaic background, is the field of ancient Near East history, studying women, before 3000 BC, the time of the goddess in the ancient Near East. And I don't know quite how to do that. And I want to, I'm talking in general now, I don't want to get too specific. The reason I don't know how to do that is because my options are as follows. I can go to some of the best schools of ancient Near East, ancient Near East history programs such as University of Pennsylvania, University of Chicago, Yale, whatever these, and then into a PhD program. Okay? Then I am thrust into a whole patriarchal system. I know some of the people who are involved, in these studies. I don't want to go through 7-8 years of my life, at this stage, and being angry and frustrated. On the other hand, if I want to get into the graduate work in women's studies, the options are not, I don't have that much to choose from. There's a women's history thing at Sarah Lawrence. And there just isn't anything happening. I mean, I'm very excited about everything that's going on here today, but where do you go to become a feminist scholar? How do you do it?
Does anybody have any ideas?
Should one of you go there?
There's the Women's History Conference.
The only thing I could suggest to you is I can give you